Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. I bet you, Tom, you didn't have a bet on that one. Tom had sent me a message on Twitter, by the way, at Deacon Punnett on Twitter, and he said that he won a bet that I'd play Der Kommissar tonight. And not only did I play Der Kommissar, I played the German version, which, you know, you should get double or nothing or something like that for that. So grab a line. You can join the conversation. We were just wrapping up. What did happen to the inner circle of Hitler's henchmen's wives at the end of the war? Lesser known is some of these outcomes. And then I'll ask James Wiley, the author of this question. I was thinking about it a lot. How many of these Nazi wives does he think would have still signed up to be married to these twisted, depraved mama's boys, repressed sexually, losers, if they had known how few years it was going to buy them in life? If they had been able to see what 1945 looked like, how many of them would have married and become one of the inner circle of Nazi wives? That's my question. We'll get to that next, and then yours on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. John Wiley, Nazi wives. So we were just breaking it down. Let's talk about Mrs. Heydrich. How did her war experience end as a Nazi wife?
Well, of course, I mean, her husband was assassinated in 1942. So she spent the last years of the war running their family estate, I suppose you'd call it, in a very brutal manner, and then fleeing Czechoslovakia back into Germany as the Soviet army got nearer. And she kind of went underground. I mean, she assumed that she would be arrested by the Allies and tried, as some of the other women were. So she went kind of underground for a couple of years and then resurfaced, I think, when she realized that actually she was going to get away with it with very minor kind of consequences. And from that point on, she was just determined to uphold her husband's reputation and determined to... Well, certainly, she never went back on her commitment to Nazi right. beliefs. So,
his reputation as a confirmed killer and one of the architects behind the extermination camps. She was in there to...
That moment when that question comes, what about the Holocaust? That's when you get the muddying of the waters, and I'm not sure he really knew that that was what was going to happen.
Right.
And
right.
He was fascinated before it really got going. So,
right.
You know, what happened, I think she said this wonderful sort of idea that, you know, he may have, his jurisdiction ended once someone went inside the camp. So he did the arresting, but after that, it wasn't his responsibility. So she did try and, you know, suggest that he didn't know quite what was going to happen. But, of course, we know full well that, you know, he was one of the main architects of the Final Solution.
A founding father of the Final Solution. Mrs. Himmler.
Mrs. Himmler just wanted to sort of stay quiet and put it all behind her, I think. You know, once she was interrogated by the Allies, she didn't give away anything at all, really. And then she kind of slipped into obscurity. It was her daughter, in fact, who took up the Nazi cause and became extremely active in the neo-Nazi movements within Germany after the war, and remained active in those circles right up until her death only a few years ago. And she, you know, was determined, as she said, to restore her father's reputation and again trying to insist that he didn't really know what was going on, and you know, it was all Hitler's idea. I mean, the usual raft of excuses that we use.
The infamous Magda Goebbels.
Well, as we know, she committed suicide with her husband shortly after Hitler killed himself, and of course was responsible for the death of her children.
Yeah, that was an interesting part. As you talk about that, whether or not it was her or the bunker doctor, there's conflicting stories about it, but that all of the children, she made sure that all of the children were dead, along with, you know, along with she and her husband ending up in a funeral pyre.
Yeah. Well, this is it. I mean, we will never, you know, whether she, you know, physically administered the cyanide herself, or whether she sat outside the room while the doctor did it for her, we will never know for sure. As you say, there are conflicting versions of it. My sense is just that by that point she was an emotional and psychological wreck, and she made the decision to kill her children as early as February 1945. Her decision was, if things go really bad, that's what's going to happen. And from that point on, she could hardly bear to be around her children at all. She'd often, just burst out into tears around them. So I'm not sure that she could have physically, walked around that room and put the poison actually into their mouth.
In their mouth.
She still let someone else do it for her. So.
Right. If the other version is true, then she was just merely waiting outside the door for it to be done. So, Mrs. Goering.
Well, Mrs. Goering, going interrogated by the Allies and held by the Allies for a number of years, but again released really without much in the way of punishment. And again, she kind of retired quietly in Munich. And she fought to have various paintings returned to her that she felt were her property. And she wrote a very self-serving autobiography where really it's all about what a wonderful life she had married to Goering. And really he's not as bad as everyone said he was. And she's sure he didn't really know what was happening. And, more puzzled really about everything than sorry or regretful. Like, well, kind of, how did that happen?
living in the eye shadow of greatness. Let me ask you the question, then we'll get to the phones. Of all of the women that you studied, and there are many more in the final chapters discuss.
For reasons of space, I had to obviously, not go into everybody, but yeah.
But you went into a lot at the end that had been, like Henrietta, and you mentioned other people too. So, of the six main women that are the focus of Nazi Wives, had they had a crystal ball and they would have seen how it ended, how their husbands were killed, how their lives ended, any way you look at it, how many of them do you think would have still signed up to be part of Hitler's harem, if you will, in that extended way?
Ilse Hess, I think, definitely. She never showed any signs of doubt. Even when, after her husband's flight to Scotland, she was ostracized. She was, essentially exiled from the Nazi movement. But she never lost faith. And she clung to her kind of twisted idealism right to the end of her life. So I think, I don't think she would have done it any differently. Don't think Lena Heydrich would have done it any differently either. She believed in what she fought for. She was instinctively a fighter. And I think it would have been against her nature to sort of say, it didn't work out very well, did it? Maybe I should have done something else. But I think she was fiercely proud. Margaret Himmler, I think, would have swapped her life for someone else's quite happily.
Right. And Magda.
Magda Diskel, isn't it? Because it's such an appalling and horrific end. And for a woman who, when she joins the Nazi movement, is an extremely extremely attractive, highly intelligent, wealthy widow, you kind of think that perhaps she would have said, well, yeah, I actually would have liked something else.
Right.
And certainly, you know, miserable in her marriage to Goebbels all those years as well. So she might, you know, I think given the option, she may have done something else, but that's, you know, that's removing the Hitler factor and her, you know, her feelings for Hitler. So very hard to say, really. I mean, hindsight, isn't it? I mean, that was one of the chief challenges of the book, writing the book, was dealing with hindsight, dealing with the fact that we know what happened.
Right.
You know? But those women, when they met their husbands, they had no idea that that was where they were going. So, yeah.
I kept coming back to thinking, as I was mulling that question, I kept coming back to the notion that so many of those women were hedonists that I think they would have not gone down that road, because they would have much that looked, if they had seen how much pain and misery and death was in front of them, I don't know what percentage of them would have said yes to that. But that's one for another time, because we have
just to say quickly on that, I do think the First World War set a kind of precedent for that kind of misery and suffering and death.
That's true.
And they all lived through that, and I think it didn't normalize that experience, but it made that kind of thing sort of more tolerable in some strange way. Anyway.
First time caller line, Lisa is in Salt Lake City for James Wiley. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you? I'm surprised I got through. Thank you. Speaking of women, you're talking about my grandmother, my grandfather. We don't know still what he had to do with that. We don't think he was in the Reich. He was a chemist, and he came up with a chemical that would weather the concrete, and it's on the Autobahn today. But anyway, my grandmother waited till I was 18. When my mom was born, she was born the same exact time Himmler's daughter was born. They were in bassinets next to each other in the hospital.
Weird.
And she waited. But as far as, like, them not knowing, you know, the pain and the misery, we're still not sure what happened to my grandfather. I just barely found out where he was buried. Hmm. But, yeah, they didn't know a lot of that stuff that was going on.
I don't know about that. You say a lot of that stuff.
I know that the wives of those people, I know my grandmother didn't. She didn't know where he was going. I'm still trying to research what was up with him. But he was a big businessman. He was never home, and she didn't know a lot of things.
Well, that may be true for your grandmother. That may be true indeed. But, James, I mean, to speak to that notion, well, if you would.
I think there's an issue of, you know, there's the details. Now, they may not have known the details, you know, but the general sense of what was happening, I think most Germans knew that something very, very bad was happening in the East. And, you know, in recent years, historians have recovered a lot of letters written by civilians and soldiers at the time, and people were openly discussing the fact that, you know, those trains heading east, you know, were not going to a good place. So people may not have known the specifics of what was going on, but really, you can't organize, you know, an extermination of that scale involving that many people without there being a general sense of what's
right.
going on. Yeah.
Let's grab Tim in Shreveport, Louisiana, on a wild card line for James Wiley. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. We'll make this as quick as possible. There was a book written by a man of Jewish faith and a Christian called The Pink Swastika, which documented the sexual predatory, the pedophilia, child molestation that went on to hit their youth and all through the top of the Nazi ranks. I don't know if you know anything about the book, but some people knew that Hitler, Nazis, the SS, Gestapo were a bunch of child molesters.
Let's go ahead and get the answer, because I think you might see some confirmation of that, although it may not have been as widespread as some people think. But, James, let's talk about that. That level of perversion, if you will, for, you know, child molesters that were going on within the, especially the early movement back in the Putsch days and before there was sort of this cleansing, if you will, of the party, if you can call it that.
Well, certainly, I mean, it's well known that around Ernst Röhm and the brown shirts, there was a very active homosexual culture. As to the child molesting, the paedophilia thing, I'm very cautious about that, again, because of the evidence is very scanty. What I would say, you know, in terms of the SS, there were two approaches to recruitment. You know, that those recruited to work in concentration camps were the worst of the worst. So amongst those were child molesters, paedophiles, rapists, and murderers. But, you know, for the bulk of the SS who weren't involved with the camp system, you know, they were lawyers and doctors and academics and respectable people. So I think, you know, if you look at the people who worked in the concentration camps, yes, you will find an awful lot of very, very twisted and perverted individuals.
I want to draw a point because I want to say, if we talk about gay people, it wasn't like the movement had, when we say it, like a gay culture, it wasn't a healthy gay culture. It was this bifurcated gay culture where people were doing things, they weren't open about it, and so there was a lot of leveraging against each other. It was a closeted organization, but they may have had a public image, but then privately, you know, so it's hard to tell because some of these people had been kicked out of one organization or another for various reasons, and they found a home in this movement, and they may have all had various agendas that brought them together in the end to look for new respectability in these brown shirts.
Yes, no, I mean, the brown shirts were, you know, very much, you know, an organization, you know, molded by Ernst Röhm and did develop its own sort of distinctive way of operating compared to the official Nazi party. And yeah, and it is, you know, one of the reasons why Hitler ordered the purge in the Night of the Long Knives was to clean house, as it were, in that respect. And certainly the regime was incredibly harsh on homosexuality. And Himmler was particularly aggressive about homosexuality.
But again, amongst a group of guys who seemed pretty repressed sexually and unable to relate to women. So there had to have been some level of self-loathing in that, too.
Yeah, there's an element of that, definitely. Yeah. Certainly in Himmler's case, I think.
And Hess, I would argue.
Yeah, but... and Hess, who knows? I mean, Hess, is almost an asexual person. He's, well, you know, I think he's, you know, he's, you know, he would have made a very good monk in the Middle Ages, I think.
Okay. All right. I'll take your word for that. East of the Rockies, Joe is in Long Island on Coast to Coast. Joe?
I have a two-part question on the psychology, James. First is, I'm surprised these people weren't hearing footsteps, the footsteps of either divine retribution or a fellow occultist retaliating against them, another witch or warlock or whatever. And my second question would be, okay, say these women did have a loathing for Polish people, the underclass, for Jewish people.
Right.
All right, why bother taking it to the level of what's killing them? Just sidestep them? You know, there's...
How did it devolve? How did anti-Semitism devolve into extermination? We'll have to hold for this, but we'll get to that answer. It's a fair question. Nazi wives, James Wiley, We'll answer that question and yours if you grab the line coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Bonnet. And listen, we just have, 24 minutes left to go. So let's make the most of it. If you can keep your questions short, we'll get to the answers right away. We'll start with the one we left off on is, how does James Wiley account for, and maybe through the lens of these Nazi wives, how does he account for how just garden variety anti-Semitism turned into extermination? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, James, we hung that question out there. So how would you account for what started as, and not even a national thing, by the way. I mean, it was only a group within Germany that was anti-Semitic. Lots of people who fought in World War I fought bravely, and they were Jewish. And there, but they was exploited definitely by the Nazi movement, who found a scapegoat for their problem. But how do you go from anti-Semitism to extermination?
Well, I think there's two things to consider. I think one of the difficulties with this is, how do you come up with a rational explanation for something that was deeply irrational?
Right.
And Hitler's pathological hatred of the Jews was always on a kind of apocalyptic scale. A kind of all or nothing, good versus evil, the fate of the world is at stake. You know, and that's the position Hitler started from. That may be not the position Germany started from, or even the Nazi movement started from, but that's where Hitler started from. And that level of the intensity of his hatred and the irrationality of it and the destructiveness of it was always there. So, you know, in terms of the actual progress towards the horror, you know, it is incremental, it is slow, but behind it, there was always that immovable fact of Hitler's attitude.
Right.
And, you know, I think once you enter the Second World War, you know, everything escalates, everything speeds up, and I think it's at that point, I think, when Hitler perhaps realized that the war could not be won, that the extermination of the Jews goes, you know, takes off, as it were.
You know, I think there's a, you know, the other thing
I'm going to bring it, the whole world down with me.
Right.
I'm bringing it all down with me. And that, you know, the negative energy within him was just, you know, extraordinary, really.
But I think there's also this connection that Judaism was synonymous with communism, and that was part of that justification, was that great fear that the communists were going to take over Germany. And so they
that was the one of the twists that Hitler gave to kind of your standard anti-Semitism of the time, was to put it together with Bolshevism and communism.
Right.
Create an even more kind of potent enemy or scapegoat.
And even what we would might call today as being sort of a deep state, that belief that, you know, sure, on the outside they may look like real Germans, but they're not on the inside. Then they're just waiting for a chance to take over. And then the whole international banker thing and all of that.
Yeah, combine, I mean, that, again, shows you this, the irrationality of it, is that one, you know, the Jews are being accused of being behind communism, but they're also being accused of being behind finance capitalism.
Right, exactly. Okay. Make up your mind. John is in Seattle on a wild card line on Coast to Coast for James Wiley. John?
Ian, hi. Now, James, you had answered my question about Hitler committing suicide, so I wanted to ask you, like, Reinhard Heydrich was Jewish, which Hitler used as leverage.
Stop. Don't declare that as a fact. It's not a fact. But go ahead. James, do you want to address the Heydrich thing?
It was a persistent rumor and a persistent slur on him by his rivals. But the reality was, he had a relative whose second husband was Jewish, and that's the closest he got to being Jewish.
Well, and his grandfather had a name that, quote-unquote, sounded Jewish?
Well, that's the second. It's not his bloodline grandfather.
Okay.
It's the second wife. It's the second husband of his grandmother who had a Jewish-sounding name. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So go ahead, John. I just want to correct that because, not that accusing somebody of being Jewish is a crime. It certainly isn't and whatever. But at the time, it's just not a historical fact that he was Jewish.
No, and it gives him a kind of excuse. It sort of says, oh, that's why he was so bad, because he was trying to hide up his past.
Well, my understanding is that there has been no conclusive evidence whether or not Hitler's grandfather was Jewish and his mother was Jewish. And I myself am a follower of Chabad. I believe the Jewish people are the salt of the earth. And when the Babylonians destroyed the Holy Temple in Israel, that God became homeless on this planet. And if anyone wants to fully understand the evil of the Nazis, they need to become, they need to become in the presence of Jews and spend time celebrating their holidays in order to fully understand the way the Jewish people live their lives, and that they're the salt of the earth of the human race.
Couldn't agree more that everybody needs to spend time with each other, especially those that they perceive to be their enemies. And I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, and I endorse that notion 1,000%. As far as Chabad is concerned, or the chosen people or other things, that becomes a slightly different argument to me, but I know what you're saying, and my only point is just I don't think that was Heydrich's motivation, although I will never cry a tear over how he died. Let's go to Walt, who's in Allentown, Pennsylvania, on a wild card line. Walt?
Ian, great conversation you got going with Mr. Wild.
Thank you.
Ian, must be about 30 or more years ago on PBS, they ran a documentary. It was called History of the SS. And they made the point that the SS welcomed women into their ranks. Now, women naturally have an instinct to nurse and to nurture life. And what they said in this documentary was that Hitler and the upper echelon of the SS considered this a weakness in women that had to be suppressed. So what they did was they had the SS women as part of their training when these poor people came in on the trains, the Jews and the gypsies and whatnot that were to be exterminated. They had these SS trainee women feed the babies to the guard dogs, believe it or not.
Okay, well, let's pause for a second because that's such a horrible thought. But go ahead, James, do you want to jump in?
There's certainly plenty of evidence of the SS, the female SS camp staff being as brutal as their male counterparts. The sort of women that they recruited often actually came from nursing or caring professions, which is very odd. And Margaret Himmler herself was a nurse in the First World War, so that's a slightly odd element to it all. But yeah, there were women sadists who worked in the camp. The SS, no question. Yeah.
But I think the notion is that they pretty much were women sadists to begin with. I mean, it wasn't like they came in all nurturing and loving and then went, whoa, no profit in that.
Yeah,
clearly
they lacked empathy.
Or they wouldn't have gotten selected to begin with. Dave is in Erie, PA, on Coast to Coast AM, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi. I never read any of the books that may have been written by the actual Nazi wives, but I read a book by Mussolini's daughter, Ada Mussolini.
Okay.
And it seemed like, the book was called My Truth by Ada Mussolini Channel. It seemed like she tried to play kind of a middle path about the whole Jewish question after the war. Like in her book, she talked about how, well, she is happy that the Jewish people finally do have their homeland back, but she also, in the same paragraph, talks about how, Well, the Jewish people still have their hands on the levers of power.
Right.
And, you know, she was like trying to take a middle-of-the-road approach
right.
to it. Did you ever read her book?
I didn't, no, I didn't, to be honest. No, I did. I mean, obviously, I mean, I've researched Mussolini to a certain extent, but I didn't read her.
It's not hard to find people that still say that sort of stuff. You know, I really, there's a lot of people that still refer to Jews as, you know, Christ killers. And then whatever happened to them, you know, that's a result of the decision they made and all of that other nonsense. So I think that kind of those torture justifications are just that. But here's the scary thought. And Dave, thanks for the question, but I'll ask James. I mean, you look at Germany, and I think roughly the figure the last time I looked was somewhere south of 8 million Germans were actually card-carrying Nazis.
Yeah.
And so you have to ask yourself, that was the entire world fought back against that. How many neo-Nazis do we think exist to this day? And is it possible that there are more neo-Nazis than there ever were real Nazis? And that is what I think we need to be ever vigilant against.
I think that's, I mean, certainly one of the things that struck me doing the research was, you know, just, you know, how close it is in time, actually.
Yeah.
You know, those events really aren't very far away.
No.
You know, my parents were in the war, you know, they grew up in the war, you know, their friends, some of them fought in the war. It's still very close in time. And some of their children are still alive. So the proximity of it, it's not, you know, it's history, but it's very, very close history. So these things never really went away. There was always a neo-Nazi presence in Germany. It's not like it was purged. It's not like it disappeared.
They just made it illegal, and therefore people, you know, suffered.
They did. I mean, you know, the numbers of ex-SS people ended up with quite good jobs.
Yeah.
You know, quite high up positions in German society. I mean, it's, you know, it's quite shocking. And
same thing with the Nazi wives. Many of them ended up prospering openly and even kind of creating
magazine interviews. Shameless, absolutely shameless. You know.
Who was the one that was still contributing to a fund that paid for the legal representation for SS guards?
Yeah, that was Himmler's daughter.
Right.
And Nina Heydrich ran a guest house for ex-SS guys to come and have a little holiday.
God.
Yeah, it is. It's not far away. It's very close. You know, it's just, you know, as you said, a couple of generations away. So it's still there. And, you know.
I had an uncle that
we know of the terrible horrors, people are still denying, people are still, as you say, making excuses or,
right.
you know.
I had an uncle who passed earlier this year who was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah,
and, you know, and he was part of the refreshing troops that came in. He wasn't in the beginning, but they brought him up from Italy, marching up with Patton, and he was there. You know, I guess kind of reinforcements that came in when they were able to rotate out some of the men who had been there from the beginning, and he took their place, and he was the only one of his platoon to survive.
Yeah.
Linda is in Spokane, west of the Rockies. Maybe the last question we get to tonight on Coast to Coast. Linda?
Hi, Ann. I just wanted to say that the story of Hitler and his officers, the men and their wives, could be a commentary of our own country and Britain. The men leadership, from politicians to educators to pastors, in every facet of leadership, is the exact same example that is going on with the wife supporting him and the sexual deviant behavior and all of it.
Or even excelling, which is really the real story. And thank you, Linda. It was a great observation. But the truth of Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany, is not that they weren't just supporting their husbands. They were pushing their husbands, and they were forcing them to become a member, an active member of something which they, had they been in a different position, they very heinously would have participated in gleefully on their own. And I do think there's something to be said for the parallel to today's times. When you're reading these stories, you realize just how easy that whole boiling frog analogy really works. And if you just do it incrementally, people buy in a little bit at a time, and the next thing you know, you do have people who are willing to see other people die so that they don't have to admit they were wrong, or because in the end they got more of what they felt they deserved. James, your last thought on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you say, it's a very slippery slope. Once you cross certain lines, other lines get easier to cross, and then slowly but surely, yeah, there is no freedom. You know, people are disappearing. But yeah, I mean, I think the key thing to remember about Hitler and the Nazi mindset was it was about warfare. War was the dominant mode of thinking. War was always the aim. So there was just the, you know, violence and hatred was hardwired into the ideology from the very beginning.
But two things stood in the way, and you make a point of this several times in the book, is that democracy stood in the way. I mean, it wasn't until Hindenburg, because he was so detached, opened the door to the fox to enter the hen house by making Hitler, who had lost, you know, had never won an election, to come in at a high-ranking position, and then immediately brought in behind him all of these other goons. Had it not been, democracy was holding it out. It wasn't allowing it in. And then the other thing is, it wasn't just democracy, it was bureaucracy. And that so much of what, I got a kick out of how many times taxes came into it, or the fact they didn't want to have to pay taxes on things. And it's like, that's so funny, because they were impoverished, and they didn't have power, and they couldn't do what they wanted to at first. Later on they could, but there were a lot of other people and a lot of paperwork that stood in their way.
I think the important thing to remember is it could have been stopped.
It could have been at many crucial times, and it wasn't. That's the lesson that we should always hold dear to us, anybody who respects freedom. Thank you so much, James. I hope you had a good time.
Great. No, it was lovely to chat. I hope you enjoyed the read and everything.
I certainly did. Nazi Wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. This would make a great gift for people who, if you have somebody in your family who's into history and they think they know everything. They don't until they read this. This will add a whole new dimension to their understanding of what happened in World War II. Good show coming up tomorrow night with George Knapp, talking about opioids and how the wrong people have been suffering, and it hasn't helped. I will look forward to listening to that, and I will talk to you again later on this month. Deus Te Amat. And I do too.